This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Avery Weinman, and I'm the host of this episode of the New Books Network series in environmental studies. Today, I'll be speaking with Dr. Joshua Dre Barnett about his book, Mourning in the Anthropocene, Ecological Grief and Earthly Coexistence, which came out in 2022 with Michigan State University Press. Dr. Barnett studies the rhetoric of earthly coexistence. How, he asks, do we come to feel and know that we are a part of and not apart from the earth that bore and sustains us? He is an assistant professor at Penn State University in the Department of Communication Arts and Sciences and holds a joint appointment at the Huck Institute for Life Sciences. In addition to the book that we'll be discussing today, he's also written numerous essays for rhetoric and environmental humanities journals, including the Quarterly Journal of Speech, Rhetoric and Public Affairs, Environmental Communication, Communication, Culture and Critique, and the Ethics and Environment. For his scholarship, Professor Barnett has received the 2022 Carl R. Wallace Memorial Award and the 2021 Early Career Award from the National Communication Association. He is an associate editor for special issues of Rhetoric Society Quarterly and an editor of Culture, Theory, and Critique, and serves on editorial boards of Rhetoric and Public Affairs, Environmental Communication, QED, a journal of GLBTQ, Worldmaking, Women in Language, and Capacious, a journal for emerging affect inquiry. In the past, Professor Barnett has offered courses on earth and rhetorics, ecological communication, more than human rhetorics, rhetorical theory, rhetorical criticism, and philosophy and rhetoric, amongst others. So his latest book, Mourning in the Anthropocene, which we're going to discuss today, uncovers the rhetorical practices that set ecological grief into motion and illuminates pathways to a more connected, more caring earthly coexistence. In 2022, it won the Tarla Rye Peterson Book Award in Environmental Communication from the National Communication Association. So with that introduction on the table, I want to say thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So we're recording this podcast in early April, in those kind of fun, very precious, delicate first few weeks of spring when the green starts to returning to the earth, flowers really start to bloom, and birds are, you know, all about twittering wildly with their apprehension of a new season to come. A great deal of your book is about the importance of connecting to more than human world and really making a conscious and concerted effort to connect with one's environment or land community. So I thought that a great way to start this podcast would be to ask you one more personal question about the early spring goings on around your home where you're based in Pennsylvania. So what kind of in your environment has really delighted and connected to you recently?
Yeah, thank you, Avery. Well, as you said, I am hailing from central Pennsylvania, and in particular, central Pennsylvania's Ridge and Valley province near the base of Tussey Mountain and on the shores of Slab Cabin Run, a small creek that wends its way eventually to Spring Creek, and then its waters make their way eventually to the Chesapeake Bay. And from this particular place, just in the last couple of weeks, we've witnessed a whole host of seasonal phenomena, including, for example, the blooming of bloodroot and wild violet and dandelions and daffodils as well. On campus, the cherry trees are blooming, and if you detect a hint of nasality in my tone, that's because my allergies are all aflutter, as they tend to be at this time of year. We've also witnessed the increasing presence of year-round birds like northern cardinals and American robins, as well as the return of many other species of birds, including chickadees and juncos and red-winged blackbirds around my house. Aside from the flowers and the birds, I've also seen an increasing number of groundhogs and chipmunks who are showing themselves more often. And then there have been the spring rains, which I mentioned to you before we got into the conversation. We've had lots and lots of rain, as we tend to have at this time of year in Slab Cabin Run. The creek across the road has been overflowing, and I'm looking at it out the window as we speak, and I can see that there are several ducks gliding gently over its overflown surface. So there's much to notice if you're paying attention. Spring is certainly a feast for the eyes and the ears and the nose. So
Yeah,
much to see here
absolutely.
in central PA.
Yeah, on my end, I'm currently based in Los Angeles, doing this interview, and one of my favorite things about spring in the particular apartment that I live in is that we have house sparrows who've made a nest in my air conditioner. They come back every single year. They really love it because it's a great place to build a nest. So it might not be audible to listeners, but if you hear kind of like wild, high-pitched chirping, it's because the eggs have recently hatched about 2 weeks ago. So every time the adult house sparrows come and fly up under the ridge to go to the nest, of course, the chicks are extremely excited about the food that they're about to receive. So it may be that the audience hears some extra, live audience noise in the background of our conversation. As I hinted at in my first question, one of your main arguments in Morning in the Anthropocene is that knowing your environment and knowing the more than human neighbors within it is an essential precondition to being able to grieve ecological losses and subsequently being able to reconfigure one's political obligations to the earth. Before delving more deeply into this argument, I'd kind of like us to take a step back. Can you tell us very broadly what your book is about and what are the main arguments you're trying to make?
Sure. Yeah. So I will say the central question for me for a long time now has been what moves people to care about and for more than human beings and ways of being? And I've been particularly interested in different kinds of what I would call ecological feelings. Ecological grief, which is the focus of this book, is one among many different kinds of ecological feelings. And so the book is really about the ways in which ecological grief can motivate forms of concern and care for the more than human world. But I try to take a step back in the book to say what motivates ecological grief, or in other words, under what conditions do we become capable of seeing more than human beings and ways of being, whether that be individual organisms or species or habitats or places or even earth systems as worthy of our grief and so also of our concern and our care. And so in the preface to the book, I really lay out a couple of premises, right? One of which is that we're living in a time of intense ecological change, and part of that change is loss, right? Whether that's biodiversity loss or extinction or other forms of environmental loss. And the second premise is that many of us seem not to be noticing or grieving those losses. And so part of the argument of the book is that we really should be grieving those losses, but we don't always have the cultural resources at our disposal to notice, much less to mourn. And so the book is really an attempt to lay out in an accessible way what some of those cultural resources might be.
Yeah, and while we're still zoomed out discussing kind of the big ideas of the book, I thought it would make sense for us to take some time to define a few of the key terms that the arguments really hinge on. So I have here a list of three. Those are rhetoric, Anthropocene, and ecological grief, and I figure we'll just go through each of them one by one. So if you could let us know kind of broadly what you mean by rhetoric, when you use it in this book.
Sure. So rhetoric is, it's an ancient term, right? And as such, it has been defined at many times by different people in different ways. Some of the classic definitions come from thinkers like Plato and Aristotle and Quintilian. Plato gives us this idea that rhetoric is really a way of moving the soul by means of speech. But for Plato, it was largely a deceptive practice. And we get ideas of rhetoric as sort of hot air or ornamental speech from that tradition. Aristotle, for his part, took a much more ambivalent approach to rhetoric and saw it as a practical and critical art of being able to ascertain what the available means of persuasion are in any given set of circumstances. Quintilian spoke of the good man speaking well, pushing us to think about the ways in which moral purpose gets wrapped up with verbal and oral artistry. and so on and so forth. There are literally hundreds of definitions of rhetoric. One that's more recent comes from a scholar named Thomas Farrell back in the early 2000s. And Farrell defined rhetoric as the art of making things matter. And in Morning in the Anthropocene and in many of my other written works, I pick up on Farrell's definition and expand it. So for me, rhetoric is a way of naming the various means by which people move one another and are in turn moved to feel differently, think differently, judge differently, and act differently. And so it's a way of naming many of the world-making practices that we are engaged in all the time and that give our world meaning and consequence and significance.
Yeah, and actually a little bit to this point, a question that is kind of now coming to me is, what is kind of the history of the field of thinking about the environment and rhetoric? This is a field that you're situated in, but kind of what is the history of the scholarship itself and where do you see yourself in relation to that trajectory?
Sure, that's a great question. So rhetoricians for a long time were not very interested in environmental matters, and in fact, explicitly so. It wasn't really until the early 80s that rhetorical scholars, at least within the U.S. American context, began to pay explicit attention to environmental matters. Most of that work came out of a tradition called public address, which was really about sort of public speaking, oratory, these sorts of things, and was interested in how folks like John Muir, for example, could move Americans to care about Hetch Hetchy. So that's where things begin. And then over the past 40 years or so, a subfield called environmental rhetoric has grown and is now prospering. I would say that the field has moved in a variety of directions. Many of us are still focused on environmental activists and how they move broader publics to care about more than human beings and ways of being or landscapes, places. Others are focused more on corporate rhetorics, industrial rhetorics, and sort of taking a critical perspective to see how it is that some of our common ideas or misconceptions about our relationship to the natural world have been shaped, sometimes by nefarious actors. And then I would say one of the emergent areas in the field now is really focused on the matter of care, right? So, and this is a theme that I pick up in my book, but really trying to think about the nuances and complexities about what it means to care for the natural world and what roles rhetoric plays both in animating and enacting that care.
Thanks for that little overview. I think that helps us to figure out where the book is in relation to the kind of broader literature and hopefully point some people in directions of things that they can read after this if they're really interested in this field and this subgenre. So another term that I would like to go over is Anthropocene, you know, a term that is in the title of the book. It behooves us to have a strong grasp of that as well.
Sure. So the term itself etymologically is formed of two parts, both of which have Greek roots. So the first part of the word comes from the Greek word anthropos, which means man or human. And the second part of the word scene comes from the Greek word kainos, which is one of two Greek words meaning new. The other is neos, but kainos means unprecedentedly new. And so just at a kind of literal level, Anthropocene is a way of naming a period of Earth history that is unprecedentedly new. And it's unprecedentedly new because humans have assumed geologic force. And it's actually out of the disciplines of geology and other sciences that we received the term. And it was pitched in the early 2000s by Paul Crutzen and Eugene Stormer as a way to name the current geological epoch. Crutzen and Stormer said, we're no longer in the Holocene. We've now entered the Anthropocene. And the defining character of our own period of Earth history is that humans have amassed geological force. We impact not just local environments, but in fact, Earth systems as well. So the atmosphere, the cryosphere, the hydrosphere, humans have impacted all of those things. And this marks a fundamentally new period of Earth history. Now, the term itself has, it has been debated and contested in a variety of arenas, but it has become particularly important to scholars in the social sciences and the humanities, really as a way of trying to grapple with the unique characteristics of contemporary life, right?
Yeah, and the last term that I would like us to go over is ecological grief.
So ecological grief is the name that some scholars, including myself, give to an experience that is itself ancient and enduring, right? But beginning in the early 2000s, scholars were trying to grapple with what it feels like to encounter environmental losses of various kinds. One of those scholars named Chris Kevorkian coined the term environmental grief, which they understood as a reaction to environmental losses, largely spurred by climate change. A decade or so later, Ashley Kunsolo and Neville Ellis coined a slightly different term, ecological grief, which they described as a natural response to environmental losses that were caused by both acute and chronic environmental changes. And for my part, I'm a rhetorical scholar, and so I have taken some issue with the ways in which both of these scholars or sets of scholars have characterized ecological grief on the one hand as a reaction and on the other as a response. In my own work, I've been thinking about ecological grief more as an achievement, as a capacity that really has to be cultivated and can be variously and differentially cultivated by the cultures in which we happen to find ourselves. Now, one additional kind of nuance here is that ecological grief works across temporalities. And so one way that we usually think about grief is that, well, someone or something has already died or been lost or disappeared. And so it has a sort of retrospective dimension to it. We look back and we try to grapple with a loss that has already occurred. But there is also an anticipatory or proleptic dimension to ecological grief, which is to say that oftentimes we are thinking ahead about, for example, a habitat that might be destroyed, an earth system that might be disrupted, a species that might go extinct, an organism that might pass away. And it is our anticipatory grief, our sense that we would grieve the loss of this other, that actually compels us or motivates us or inspires us to act on their behalf in the present.
I really like your framing of ecological grief as an achievement, as something that we are, you know, have the capacity to cultivate this feeling of grief for the environment. And in your book, you kind of focus on three main paths towards this achievement. Those three paths being naming, archiving, and making visible. This makes up really the substance of the book, the chapters of the book. Without spoiling too much of the book itself, since it is, you know, what the entire work is about, can you briefly guide us through these three paths? So through naming, archiving, and making visible.
Sure. And I'll just say, you know, at the outset of this answer, that these are not the only pathways, right? These are not the only rhetorical practices that can open us onto relations of ecological grief. But there are three that I think are particularly important and particularly prominent, at least within the culture from which I hail. So as you said, naming, archiving, and making visible sort of constitute the three major chapters of the book. Naming for me is complicated, and I talk about why it's complicated in the chapter, right? Because on the one hand, naming is one of the means by which humans can exert control over others, right? If I can name it, I can possess it. But also there are cultural politics around naming and which names get to stand within a given culture. There's a long history in the United States, for example, of settler colonists displacing indigenous names. So there's a violent edge to naming that I don't want us to lose sight of. At the same time, naming is also a way that we as humans make ourselves at home on Earth. It's a way that we become familiar with not only other humans, but with other phenomena, with other than human beings, with places. And so it's a way of fomenting familiarity. And this is really the dimension or one of the dimensions of naming that I focus on in the book. Archiving, for its part, is really about gathering together right, in a variety of ways. So when I talk about archiving, I'm not just talking about institutional archives, the sort of archives that might come to mind when you hear that term. I'm really thinking about collections of information. In the book, I focus in particular on phenological archives, or the archives that people have created of seasonal and cyclical events. We may talk about that at some point today. But I'm interested in how archives enable us, on the one hand, to look back, right, and understand historical unfoldings that otherwise we wouldn't have been able to notice because they aren't present to us in the moment. And on the other hand, the ways in which those very same archives can enable us to fashion stories or narratives about who we will become in the future. So archives in the book really are a way of revealing losses that are both past and to come. Finally, making visible, this is really for me a capacious set of rhetorical practices, and it probably should really be called like making visible slash tangible slash audible slash et cetera, right? Because what I'm really trying to get at with this notion of making visible is that humans engage in a wide variety of practices, many of them artistic, that are really about bringing a phenomena before the eyes, the ears, the senses, so that we can imagine it more fully, and so that we can imagine the consequences of its loss more fully.
Across these three paths, is there a specific example or piece of art or case or piece of literature that you use that sticks out to you as particularly indicative or representative of the points you're trying to make, perhaps that you can share with us?
Yeah, well, I think it's no surprise that two passenger pigeons are on the front cover of the book. And although the book is certainly not about the passenger pigeon, passenger pigeons do make appearances throughout, especially in the naming chapter, and then again in the chapter on visuality and the imagination. And so I think, you know, in some ways, the book began with the passenger pigeon because I began to learn in 2018 about the story of Martha the passenger pigeon. Martha was the very last passenger pigeon, and she died on in September of 1914. And it struck me that part of the reason that Martha received so much attention at the time, and part of the reason why we're still talking about Martha, is because she was called Martha, right? She had a proper name. And there's something about being given a proper name, being able to utter a proper name, being able to remember a proper name that creates a kind of tether between those of us who can know and utter that name and that which has been named. And so naming for me became a really fundamental way of thinking through how, in this case, a linguistic practice becomes part of the foundation for this ecological feeling that we call grief.
Yeah, and with this example and these building blocks kind of in place, I want to return us a little bit back to the idea of the main argument of the book, which is to ask in a more concerted way here, how can ecological grief be transformed into a positive force for human and environmental reconciliation?
Yes, this is a great question. And I want to turn here to a term that we haven't talked about yet, which is grievability, which I take up and work with from the scholar Judith Butler. Butler thinks through and theorizes grievability across a series of texts, really beginning in the late in the late 1900s, as my students would say, and the early 2000s in response to war. And Butler was trying to think about the ways in which different kinds of lives are rendered variously grievable through various kinds of cultural frames. So what is grievability? I think one way to understand it is to flip the term on its head and say ability to grieve. And in thinking through this, it's really important to sort of bear in mind that for Butler and for me in the book, this ability to grieve is not something that is inherent, right? It is something that can be culturally and rhetorically cultivated or not in relationship to specific others. But the other piece of the puzzle for grievability is that it is a presumptive position that one takes up in relationship to another. The logic of grievability is something like, if this other were to be lost, I would grieve their loss. And because I would grieve their loss, I will do what I can in the present to stave off their loss. Right. And so in this anticipatory way, reavability says, well, this other matters to me in some way. This other matters in such a way that I would rather live in a world with this other present than with this other not present. And because that is the relationship, I will do what I can. And that will mean different things in different contexts. I will do what I can to support this other's well-being and perhaps even the conditions that make their flourishing possible. And so I think it's that logic of grievability which really makes ecological grief such a powerful force. I'll just give you one example. That's a fairly abstract way of talking about it. So let me give you an example from my own life. I came into conservation work through fly fishing. I grew up fly fishing in North Georgia. And in North Georgia, there are these tiny, beautiful little native fish called brook trout. And the brook trout have been imperiled in a variety of ways through development, climate change, and so on and so forth. And when I was a teenager, I got involved with a conservation organization called Trout Unlimited. And really, our aim was to do what we could, right, to support the flourishing of brook trout and other trout in not only in North Georgia, but throughout the U.S. And I, at the time, of course, would not have characterized the work that we were doing as being in any way motivated by grief, anticipatory or otherwise. But in retrospect, it's very much possible to see that work, and that work is continuing today, as really a product of feelings of anticipatory grief, right? Of a kind of concern about the future of this particular species, the habitats that make its flourishing possible, but also the relationships that gather around that species, whether that's for fisher folks or others who are in some way entangled with the species.
Yeah, I love that. And I love the personal angle. My dad is a big fly fisher. I'm currently in LA, but I grew up in Northern California in kind of like a more rural area of the state. And so that's also something that feels, you know, a shared ecosystem, shared relations that we have. Now I want us to turn to a few more specific questions related to the book. I think we've done a really great job. You've done a really great job laying out the big ideas of the work. But I want to take us down a few more specific estuaries here on the river that we're discussing. So the first of these questions is that you return to a quote by Aldo Leopold. His famous and kind of classic now at this point. It's kind of a memoir. It's a little bit of a scattershot of a book, but his famous classic work, Sand County Almanac, several times. And that quote is, "One of the penalties of an ecological education is that one lives alone in a world of wounds." On its face, also just like a very well put sentence, like very memorable. But I want to ask you to unpack your understanding of this quote. And I want to ask if you agree with Leopold that one does grieve alone when one gains a greater understanding of the ecological world around them. Or do you think that one of the objectives of making ecological grief more accessible, more visible, is that such grief becomes communally practiced and culturally inscribed?
Great. Yeah. So I always think about this particular quote, which comes from Round River, one of Leopold's essays, in conjunction with another line, which comes from the Prairie Birthday chapter of a Sand County Almanac. And that line is that we grieve only for what we know. We grieve only for what we know. And so I think the thing that, aside from sort of a sense of grief and mourning that ties these two sentences together, is a sense of knowing. Right, which for Leopold is working across a couple of different registers here. Right, he was an ecologist, and in this moment, he's talking about ecological education. Right, and so of course he is in some senses talking about education as we typically think about it. You know, ways of coming to know how ecosystems work, how species interact, and so on and so forth. But I don't think that Leopold is suggesting that we all need to become ecologists. And so I think that education and knowledge are also working here in a more vernacular sense, right? Of how do we come to know, how do we come to be familiar with, intimately engaged with the land communities that we already inhabit, right? And so it's really about, you know, how do we engage in habits and practices? And Leopold was a great model of many of these habits and practices that leave us feeling more rather than less connected to the places where we live, the more than human others with whom we share those spaces, and the larger processes and phenomena that underwrite them. And so with all of that being said, right, is it really the case, as Leopold says, that one of the penalties of an ecological education is that one lives alone in a world of wounds? Well, yes and no, right? I think at the time, right, for someone like Leopold, at a time when the ecological sciences were still in many ways nascent, right, this kind of communal view of how the land works and being able to see not only when parts, so to speak, are present and working well, but also when parts are missing and when the ecosystem is struggling in one way or another, that was all fairly new, right? And so from his historical angle, I think it's certainly the case that he might have felt somewhat alone, even if he was alone with his peers in the ecological sciences and the larger conservation world of which he was a part. But I think he was also really interested in laying the groundwork for a communal grief to come. And that's why, you know, he was writing in the mid-20th century, both of these essays, and he was providing us at the time with a language, with a vocabulary for understanding what it is like to endure environmental losses of various kinds. And so I think he was already anticipating the sort of conversation that you and I are having right now. He was already anticipating the kind of conservation work that I was engaged in as a teenager, where people who wouldn't necessarily invoke the language of grief or mourning were nevertheless allowing or being moved by their grief for these tiny native fish to compel them into all sorts of actions, right? And so certainly I think it's the case that shared knowledge can breed shared communities. Shared communities give us a sense of shared responsibility. And when we have a sense of shared responsibility, the burden of feeling like we have to fix all of the Earth's ills is, it doesn't go away, but it is distributed, right, in a very different way. And so we can move from that shared responsibility to a shared form of work. And that work throughout, I call that throughout my written work, the work of earthly coexistence, right? Which is trying to figure out how do we dwell in relationships of relative harm and harmony, and how do we bend those relations more towards harmony than harm?
Beautiful. And continuing on this theme of making these kind of communally practiced things, inscribing them in culture, I want to continue on this idea, because something else that you take up in this book and think through is the connection between ecology and culture and indigenous lifeways, epistemologies, and settler colonialism and ecological destruction, all as like a larger part of the machinery of domination, supremacy, et cetera, power that has taken place in the United States and elsewhere, even though your focus is on the United States in this book. So big ideas here, but I'm wondering if you can kind of take us through this dimension of thinking about ecological grief and how it relates to a broader axis of power that you're critiquing.
Right. Well, I actually have to say here that I'm really indebted to one of the reviewers of the book who, when the book was still in a nascent stage of development, suggested that I not shift focus entirely, but that I make more space in the larger project to take up histories related to, for example, the dispossession of land of indigenous peoples, dispossession of cultures of indigenous peoples, and so on and so forth in the U.S. So I have that particular reader to thank for pushing me in a direction that I might not have had the confidence to go in otherwise. And so I think it is the case that, at least within the context of the United States or really North America more broadly, we can't think through environmental devastation without also thinking through cultural devastation, right? For many hundreds of years, these two forms of devastation have been deeply and inextricably intertwined in a variety of ways, to such an extent that, in fact, some scholars of ecological grief argue that a particular form of ecological grief is present within indigenous cultures in ways that differ markedly from the kinds of ecological grief that settler cultures experience. And part of the argument there is that because indigenous peoples are so tied to particular places and particular relationships, that when those relationships are severed, when those ties to particular places, particular species, particular seasonal rhythms and patterns are broken, it's not just a loss of another, right? It's actually a deeply personal and cultural loss as well. And so throughout the book, I try to pull on a variety of examples from Native American groups, both past and present, to try to think through the ways in which the environmental and ecological losses are deeply entangled with those cultural losses. One of the ways that I do that in the naming chapter, for example, is to talk about the ways in which settler colonists often simply erased indigenous names, and the ways in which settler colonists also deliberately and intentionally tried to separate indigenous peoples from their languages through residential schools and other means. And it's not just a linguistic practice that goes away, it's a whole way of relating. Right. And so, yeah, again, I think it's really important to keep the cultural and the ecological linked.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, naming, one of the most memorable examples in the book is it's a quite a short section in the book. But you mentioned there's, I believe, like a river in Alaska that the settler name, the American name for it, is something like Gold River, Gold Creek. But if you look at the indigenous name, I believe it's something along the lines of like the flounders at like the river's meeting. And you go into like great analysis of like really the very different paradigmatic approaches evinced in the language there. So, you know, Gold Creek points us towards, you know, the literal description of an area, perhaps like a resource that can be extracted from an area, whereas the indigenous name kind of points us towards all of the social relations that are embedded in a particular place. And thinking about that kind of example, I think did so much to really put on the table, like, what is the difference here? And then like, what is at stake also in kind of the renaming and papering over of these kind of indigenous epistemologies?
Right. Yeah. And the striking and really depressing piece about that story is that it's only one of thousands, right, of examples where we see very different ways of naming and then very different ways of relating. The indigenous name that you mentioned a moment ago, sort of the place where flounders gather, right, is all about reciprocity, right? It's about understanding what this particular place makes possible for us, but also about instantiating certain relationships of responsibility to that particular place. Whereas Gold Creek, right, is entirely about a resource, and it's a resource that can be extracted for a variety of reasons, but most importantly, extracted for profit, right? But which also comes with all of these devastating environmental impacts that also bear upon different peoples in different ways.
This is, of course, a book that is about grieving and encouraging people to expand their capacity to grieve. I'm curious to know how grief has been present in people's reactions to the book, and if folks share with you their own stories of ecological grief in response to having read your work. And I guess the way to phrase that as a question is, how do you, as a co-mourner, and also as the author of this text, manage this kind of response?
Yeah. Well, I'll answer this question by mentioning two letters that I received recently from readers, one of whom was writing from Chicago and the other who was writing from northern Minnesota. The person from Chicago wrote to me to share a blog piece that he had actually written in which he had taken up some of the ideas from my book. But the blog post wasn't really about my book. It was about a hackberry tree. A hackberry tree that this particular person had interacted with for many years. He had witnessed it in various states of decline over those many years. And because it was in a public place, indeed in a public park, he eventually made the decision to contact the city or whoever else was responsible for maintaining the park and encouraging them to essentially cut it down, right? Because it had become a hazard to people who were walking in and around its midst. So I get stories like this all the time about the ways in which individuals who read the book become attuned to their relationships with whether it's trees or places or other species in different ways, right? And how the book provides them with a kind of language for thinking through the complex tangle of emotions that one experiences when one is witnessing a loss, or in this case, when one is actually actively taking part in the loss of a particular being in the hopes of securing some other kind of future. The other letter that I got is equally complicated. It came actually from a friend of mine who had gotten around to reading the book, and she's a quilter, And she's a fantastic quilter and takes it very seriously and has a lot of quilting machinery and supplies. And after she read the book, she said, I'm in my quilting room and I'm looking around at all of this stuff that I have accumulated, all of this fabric, all of this material, which of course has complicated histories of production. Some of the practices of producing those materials are themselves environmentally damaging. And she just, I felt bad, but you know, she finished the book and then is looking around at her quilting supplies and is thinking, oh my gosh, I thought I was doing this really nice thing for friends and family by creating these quilts for them. And now I feel like I've been unwittingly participating in various forms of environmental disruption. And as an author, right, that was a complicated letter to receive, right? Because I don't want readers to leave the book necessarily feeling like bad about themselves or bad about their own activities. And yet on the other hand, I thought it is striking, right, that a reader would take this notion of ecological grief in that direction. And so it's, for me, and I haven't actually responded to this letter yet. Maybe talking about it here will finally spur me to create some kind of response. But it's I suppose, inspiring to me to hear a reader take so seriously, right, their own engagement with the world. I don't think this person should stop quilting. I think that the work that they're doing is really good for their friends and family and community. But to think through very carefully the ways in which we are implicated in and complicit, often unwittingly, often unknowingly, right? Often unthinkingly, in practices that may nevertheless have negative consequences on watersheds, for example. That matters to me, right? So,
yeah. And have you noticed in the responses that you're getting that responses tend to be more oriented towards like the self and how like I am like interacting with the environment, I am, you know, contributing to the degradation of the things around me? Or have you noticed, and I suppose it's actually more visible in the first letter, that you're getting kind of more horizontal view type letters of people noticing more what is around them, kind of thinking more capaciously in those kind of like two directions? Have you noticed a trend in responses to the book?
I think it's roughly 50-50, right? And part of it has to do, I think, with the relationship between grief and mourning, right? We oftentimes think about grief as a kind of internal, private response to a loss or a potential loss, whereas we think of mourning more as a kind of public or externalized expression or articulation of that internal feeling. And of course, in the book, I try to trouble the relationship between that sort of presumed relationship between grief as being primary, mourning as being secondary, one as being private, one as being public. But I often think it is the case, you know, that some people are already in communities. This gentleman who was trying to figure out what to do with the hackberry at his beloved hackberry at his beloved park, right, was already a part of kind of an association of people who were stewards of the place and were thinking together about how to relate. But I oftentimes also have readers who are kind of just processing, right, their own feelings and emotions in response to the kinds of losses that I bring up in the book, but that are also being brought up again and again in our wider culture. And so it seems to me to be split 50-50.
It's interesting. Okay, for my last question for this interview, I want to ask, this book came out in 2022, so 2 years ago, and that's a big window and a large quantity of ecological grief to build up. So thinking about this passage of time, I want to ask what kind of changes you've noticed from today to the publication of your book. Do you think of your arguments any differently? What kind of ecological and phenological changes have you observed yourself? Are you more optimistic or less optimistic about the prospects that you put on the table for a recalibration of ecological grief and our ability to feel it? Feel free to answer in whatever way you like. It's kind of open-ended, just as to what you've noticed with this own little small passage of time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as I was finishing up this book, I was also beginning to think, as academics do, about the next project, right? And it's like, okay, kind of been thinking about ecological grief for a long time. I'm sort of bummed out, even though I do, you know, even though I do believe that ecological grief is can be a catalyst for care and conservation and other kinds of environmental work. But I wanted to work on something happier, so to speak. And so I stumbled into the literature on care, and I thought, oh, great, now I'm going to write about care, and this will be a happier project. And at the same time, I was learning a lot about the eastern hemlock and its relationship to an invasive pest species, both of terms that I put in quotation marks, but you can't see that if you're listening, the hemlock woolly adelgid. And so for the past several years, I've really been examining how it is that people across the eastern United States and Canada are working to safeguard the eastern hemlocks, right? Populations of which have been ravaged for the past 50 or 60 years by this teeny tiny insect that was accidentally introduced to the U.S., from Asia back in the 50s. And so part of what that work has reminded me again and again, right, is that so much of the care and the concern that has been lavished on this species of native conifer has really come from a place of anticipatory grief, right? As people began to witness the loss of eastern hemlocks, either at their homes or on their property or in public parks like Shenandoah National Park or the beautiful Cook Forest State Park in western Pennsylvania, they began to gather together and assemble and think about what they could do to protect the species. Now, the ways that they have endeavored to protect the species are themselves complicated. The care work that they're engaged with is often incredibly violent. They use insecticides, for example, to kill the insects. Those insecticides have downstream consequences. In other cases, they're using what are called biological controls, essentially other non-native species that they hope to consume, the quote-unquote invasive hemlock woolly adelgids. But nevertheless, right, the work has unfolded. In many ways, it's very inspiring. I think it has offered for me a very concrete case of the ways in which grief and care can entangle. And just like the example of the river in Alaska, which has been named by different peoples in very different ways and instituted very different relationships, what's going on in relationship to the eastern hemlock is just one among many thousands of stories of people who are gathering together in community to work on behalf not just of other species, but our collective capacity to dwell well together. And so even as it's complicated, it does give me some hope that in small but significant ways, we can indeed change what it means to dwell on Earth.
I think that with that hopeful and at least full of care kind of concluding sentiment, that's a great place for us to end today. And I want to thank you so much for a very thoughtful and I think very heartening conversation about the book. So thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, Avery.